Afternoon, Your Honors. It is axiomatic.
Excuse me, could you state your name for the record, please, before you tell us what's axiomatic?
Absolutely. It's axiomatic that my name is Brent Case, number 36623, representing the Pelham School District, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Axiomatic that not every duty of a school bus driver constitutes operation of a school bus under the law. What's at issue in this case, an alleged omission in supervising students on a bus, is related to direction and control of passengers, not a function of the bus. This is not operation of a motor vehicle under the law, and the waiver therefore shouldn't apply. There's been somewhat of an evolution of the law on this motor vehicle operation waiver. In the Johnson case cited in our brief, the court used the dictionary definition, calling operation a mode of action, work, exercise of power, or to run or control the function of. Now, the Stockwell case, obviously a case that we cite in our brief, was a claim rejecting that supervision of passengers on a bus was operation of a motor vehicle. That case seemed to limit the word operation to functions related to driving. Now, the Harris case that followed it somewhat expanded the definition of the term operation, but only so far. The rule on this matter is that operation of a motor vehicle constitutes the actions of the operator related to physical control of functions of the motor vehicle. Now, when it comes to a passenger bus, there's been several cases of this court concerning what exactly are functions of a passenger bus. The Johnson case held that the function including stopping the bus, driving the bus and stopping it in a particular location. And the Harris case indicated that a function of a passenger bus included ensuring passengers board and disembark safely. Now, the injuries at issue in this case, Your Honors, have nothing to do whatsoever with the driver's physical control of a function of the bus. Unlike the driver in Johnson who stopped the bus in apparently the wrong place, or the driver in Harris who forgot to clean the snow and ice off the bus steps, or Young, which I'll get to in a moment. Rather, the injuries in this case stemmed from what one student did to another student. Now, the direction, control, and supervision of students, that may be a function of a school bus driver, but that's distinct from a function of a bus. Nothing about the bus caused the injury in this case. The presence of a bus itself doesn't invoke the waiver. I sort of liken it to somebody trying to say that a conversation is attorney-client privilege just because an attorney was there. Just because this happened on a bus, that doesn't invoke the waiver. And there's no evidence that the General Assembly intended to expose school districts to liability for assaults on a school bus while denying claims for those very same assaults that took place in the schoolyard. Other courts from around the nation agree with this exact point of view. We cited them in our brief, published cases in Ohio, the Doe case, which held that supervision of students on a bus was an operation. The Garza case, Texas Court of Appeals case, in which supervision of students on a bus was not use. And the Quasti case, Pennsylvania case, in which the court determined that likewise supervision did not constitute operation.
Mr. Case, in the briefs there is mention made that the school bus driver had to brake when she saw her son and the other students stand up in the bus. Did that act of braking constitute a physical manifestation of operation of the vehicle?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I would agree that it would. However, the injuries at issue in this case have nothing whatsoever to do with the braking. I believe the complaint says something to the effect of the bus driver looked up in the mirror and saw that there was a student standing up, coming forward, and tapped on the brakes. Doesn't have anything to do with the injuries here, which stemmed from an assault of one or more students on the plaintiff. The plaintiff and the district court, Your Honors, used the Young case of this court to determine that the motor vehicle, operation of a motor vehicle waiver applied to these facts. but that was error. The Young case is easily distinguished from the facts at hand.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Could you give me your definition of operation of a motor vehicle?
Well, Your Honor, I'll give you the court's definition.
Well,
I endorse the operation of a motor vehicle waiver that's found in Harris. That operation constitutes the actions of the operator related to physical control of the functions of the motor vehicle. Now, in the Young case, it's distinguishable on two fairly obvious counts. First of all, the Young case made its decision on equating the action at issue with ensuring safe boarding on the bus, which
that was the juveniles in the handcuffs case.
Yes, Your Honor, juveniles and not only juveniles, but they were prisoners, handcuffed prisoners being transported from one facility to another. Has nothing to do. The Harris case held that ensuring safe boarding and embarkation of buses did in fact constitute a operation of a motor vehicle, of a bus specifically, and that's not at issue here. Second, what Judge Furman noted on a moment ago, the context of Young is entirely different. This wasn't a passenger bus, it was a prison van involving the transportation of handcuffed juveniles. They were completely, the court notes, they were completely dependent on the van driver to secure them in seatbelts because they were handcuffed. And the injuries in that case resulted when the van driver didn't fulfill that function. You'll also note that the court exclaims that it was making this holding under the circumstances of that case only, which obviously are not present here.
Mr. Case, in the Young opinion, I believe it was Judge Lichtenstein who distinguished Young from the Stockwell case for various reasons, including that Stockwell was decided when there was a different interpretation of whether waivers should be construed narrowly or broadly. So how does that factor in here, if at all?
Well, I don't think it does factor in at all, Your Honor, because the fact of the matter is if we look at the rule declared in Harris, the court in Stockwell would have reached the same result. So it's true that there was a Colorado Supreme Court case decided after Stockwell, which suggested that the waiver should be construed more broadly, whereas the Stockwell court appeared to construe that waiver very narrowly, appearing to define the operation of a bus to only matters related to the driving of that bus. After Stockwell and the Harris case, the Harris came up with the broader definition that I've said a couple of times already, that it doesn't necessarily have to do or have to relate strictly to driving, but it still must relate to a function of the bus. So the fact of the matter is while I'm not necessarily saying that Stockwell requires that you reverse in this case, but I'm saying that the rule of Harris would have required the Stockwell court to reach the same result, because supervision of the passengers, direction and control of the passengers on the bus, is distinct from a function of the bus itself. In the Stockwell case, much like our case, the fact of the matter is that there was nothing specific about the bus that related to the injuries. The court, I think even the Young court notes that in the Stockwell case, the assault head issue coincidentally took place on a bus. And that's what we have in our case, is that the assault, there's nothing special about the fact that this happened on a bus that caused the injuries in this case.
But does the fact that there's a district, apparently a district seating plan, sweep it within the functions of the bus driver and the operation of the vehicle?
Good question, Your Honor. My position is that it does not. Also, I think we have an allegation. Well, there were allegations in other cases. I think the courts from around the nation that we cited, which provided that watching the students was part of the bus driver's job description. And that may be the case, but it still doesn't have anything to do with the function of the bus. That's what we have to keep coming back to, is that were the injuries caused by a function of a bus, not a lapse in supervision, not a failure to follow a school district policy or procedure. It all comes down to was it a function of the bus? And the answer in this case is no.
Isn't the term operation? You're using the term function. It's operation of a motor vehicle.
Well, that's the term in the waiver, or that's what the statute says in the waiver. The Harris Court says that operation means the actions of the operator related to physical control of functions of the motor vehicle. So operation is that term is defined and narrowed somewhat by this court's definition, that operation under the waiver strictly has to do with control of the functions of the bus. Your Honors, I also suggest that it would be against public policy for this court to affirm the district court's finding of a waiver in this case. The term operation of a motor vehicle can't be reasonably extended to encompass a bus driver's supervision of his or her passengers. One of the purposes of the CGIA, the Government Immunity Act, is to allow the government to provide essential services that liability could disrupt or make prohibitively expensive, and expanding the motor vehicle operation waiver to include supervision of bus passengers would do exactly that. With that, Your Honor, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Case.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Philip W. Snyder, Durango. I'd like to say there's something about my name that's axiomatic, but actually it's just hereditary from my father and my grandfather. This case really boils down to one simple question. How broadly does this court construe the term operation? Defendants heavily rely on Stockwell versus Denver RTD, but that decision really doesn't apply to this case at all. In Stockwell, a division of the court held that operation of a motor vehicle didn't pertain to acts of violence by passengers on a public bus, since providing security to passengers was not necessary for the bus driver to operate the vehicle. Second point, procedurally, in Stockwell, the court found that the plaintiff did not actually even allege that his injuries were caused by any act or omission of the driver. But in the case before you now, we've not only alleged that the negligence of the school bus driver led to the injuries sustained by the child, but also that the school district had established a seating policy as a passenger security measure to prevent the very type of conduct by other children which led to my client's injuries. So the differences between this case and the Stockwell case are sharp and dramatic. In Harris, the court applied a much broader definition of operation when a plaintiff sued the RTD again after she slipped on accumulated ice and snow on the steps entering the bus. So the Harris court, under post-Walton, says, well, the movement of passengers into and out of the bus is controlled by the bus driver. And thus it held that cleaning the ice and snow off the steps was part of the operation. The Harris court noted that the GIA was in derogation of the common law and grants of immunity were to be strictly construed against the public entity. And the waiver provisions were to be broadly and deferentially construed in favor of the victims. So given that deference, the court held that operation of a motor vehicle is a broad term which includes both the physical defects of a motor vehicle and its movement, as well as other actions fairly incidental to those defects or movements.
Mr. Snyder, the statement in Harris about the movement of passengers being controlled by the driver, in your view, state a general statement of law, or is that specific to the facts of that case?
I think it's specific to the facts of that case, a public bus, not a school bus. In this case,
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your statement.
This case is distinguishable because there was a seating policy in place. That's what we have alleged. There was a seating policy. Children like my client, 7 years old, sat towards the front of the bus. Children like the two juveniles alleged in the complaint, 15-year-old, both of them, sat in the back of the bus. They were not supposed to come together to prevent bullying.
I didn't see anything in the complaint that was filed or in the response to the motion to dismiss that stated that the bus driver was in any way responsible for enforcing that policy, if indeed it was a policy.
We stated the policy. We stated that she was aware that violations of the policy had taken place and she did nothing to stop it. I believe it says that in the complaint. Maybe I'm wrong, but I believe we allege those facts.
Okay.
So my question would be, is enforcement of a seating policy, if there is one established, not fairly incidental to the movement of the bus? Another way to ask that is, would the bus be allowed to move if there was not enforcement of the seating policy?
Mr. Snyder.
Isn't a bus like the Simpsons TV show?
Sorry to interrupt. How would you define operation of a motor vehicle?
Operation, to me, would include everything that is inherent to the safe operation of the vehicle itself. And if that means kids running up and down the aisles, then a bus driver has an obligation to pull over and stop. If a bus driver on the RTD sees that there's an attack in the back and continues driving down to the next exit and doesn't stop to call the police or do something about it, that would include that. Did that bus driver in Stockwell have an obligation to stop the bus, get out of his seat, go back and physically intervene? No. Did they have some other obligation? Don't know. Was that alleged? I didn't see it in Stockwell. The Young Court took the whole concept of operation a logical step further, holding that when a police officer transports handcuffed juveniles in a transport van, that he needs to seatbelt those passengers in. I see no real distinction between a physical seatbelt, whether it's imposed by Colorado state law or not, or just good common sense, of putting a seatbelt on passengers who cannot affix their own seatbelt and securing them safely in a vehicle, and the enforcement of a mental seatbelt. You sit in this seat, you do not get up and move to another seat during the course of this operation of the motor vehicle. We don't think there's a meaningful difference between transporting a juvenile secured with a seatbelt or a school bus driver requiring students to stay in their same seats.
Mr. Snyder, how would you distinguish the out-of-state cases cited by your opponent where there were sexual assaults and the courts in those cases held that the bus driver didn't even have an opportunity to or an obligation to do anything in those circumstances because supervision was not part of the operation of the bus?
Let me deal with that directly. In Doe versus Marlton School District, which they rely on, I would ask, would a school bus driver not be responsible in any way, or would the school district not be responsible in any way if there had been a seating rule in place that separated the boys from the girls on either side of the bus because of a history of previous incidents of sexual molestation, and that during the course of operating the vehicle, the bus driver became aware that one of the boys had moved over and was sitting next to one of the girls in violation of the rule? I think the Court of Ohio would have come out with a different conclusion. And I think if a case with those facts were presented to this court would come out with a conclusion that's akin to Young. As far as the Quaist case, as far as Garza's estate, those two cases are pre-Walton. They're both back from the 1980s. There was absolutely no discussion in that case about other facts that would in any way parallel what we have here, and that is an enforceable seating policy, that for whatever reason, the bus driver chose not to enforce. We've alleged she was aware of the harassment. She could see in the rearview mirror. She heard the boy cry out, and she did nothing. She could have stopped it. She could have enforced the seating policy. And I wouldn't be here today. The court should also pay attention to DeRay versus, I can't remember the plaintiff in the case, or the defendant, but it was the federal case that we cited, an opinion written by Chief Judge Krieger. And she applied Harris and Young principles, definitions of operation of a motor vehicle, and allowed a case to go forward where a person who'd been detained was, instead of in compliance with police department regulations that the detainee be placed in the back seat, was allowed to be put in the front seat. He managed to escape, jump out of the car in the middle of heavy traffic, was run over and killed. And that case was allowed to go forward, again, based on the principles of Harris and Young. The importance here is that the children, the older children, were known to have moved up to a position close to the seven-year-old, were harassing the seven-year-old. He was complaining about it. And the driver had not only the right and not only the ability, but probably also had the obligation to stop the bus and make the teens return to their assigned seats. As such, we think her conduct falls within the broad definition of operation of a motor vehicle, so we respectfully ask the court to deny the school district's appeal on that point, affirm the trial court's ruling, and allow the case to proceed to trial on the merits.
Mr. Snyder, I wanted to follow up and ask you about the school district's policy. Do you know if there is anything in the record that indicates whether it was a written policy?
We do not know, Your Honor. We, of course, never got to any discovery phase at all. This case went straight up on a motion to dismiss and on appeal. So there's been no discovery whatsoever conducted to find out even the truth behind our allegations that there was a seating policy. We obviously have good faith belief or we wouldn't have made those allegations. Whether there was a written policy or not, I do not know at this time.
And I gather you're assuming or certainly asserting that whatever the contours of that policy were, that was part of the bus driver's responsibility to enforce that policy.
Correct.
And what is your basis for making that assertion?
Simple logic, Your Honor. Since we don't have anything more in the record, I have to assume that if a bus driver is told we have a seating policy in place, this is the policy, this is the way it will be carried out, that she understands she has a duty to enforce the policy, not to simply ignore it and go willy-nilly down the road. If I can get to our cross-appeal point. Again, this is a very simple point, and it depends on an answer to really one question. Is there one and only one reasonable interpretation or inference to the appearance of the mother's name on the notice letter? If there is one and only one, to the exclusion of all others, then our cross appeal will fail. I understand that. But if there are other reasonable inferences or interpretations, then this case should be, or that claim should be, reinstated. So what would be the factual or a legal basis for such inferences? First, her name is undeniably on the letter that was timely filed. Second, her name is immediately below that of the injured child. Third, yes, the abbreviation C/O is generally for mailing, but it could have also been intended to identify which parent was making the claim for the child, which parent would be the responsible one in this particular situation. Fourth, because a minor does not have a capacity in a legal sense to make such a claim. Someone has to make it for him. That person was identified in the notice letter. Fifth, a parent bears the responsibility for all the medical expenses of any kind that are incurred related to this particular type of claim. And sixth, since there is no loss of consortium, no loss of filial consortium recognized in Colorado, a parent only has a claim for medical expenses and other healthcare related costs that are incidental to the child's injuries. So there really is nothing there. It's logical to conclude that she was identifying herself as the responsible parent who would be bringing the claim on behalf of her child. If a reasonable inference on any or all of those six points can be drawn by this court, then the trial court should have conducted a Trinity hearing to weed out those unintended reasonable inferences and determine if there was a good faith attempt. There was no compliance with the Woods-Mall evaluation test. There was nothing in the court order that indicates there were any findings other than looking at the notice letter, period. There was nothing to query the claimant as to her intent, whether it was a good faith attempt to give notice, and there was absolutely nothing whatsoever put up by the defense or inquired into by the judge as to what prejudice the defect in the notice letter had caused the school district. So the only logical conclusion is that the court applied a strict compliance test. The case law is completely against that, and we ask that you either remand it for a Trinity hearing, or if you find evidence sufficient, just simply reverse the trial court's opinion and reinstate that part of the claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Your Honors, you need not reach the cross appeal if you find in the school district's favor on ours. And so I'll rest on the arguments made in our brief regarding the cross appeal. I wanted to comment on a few of the things that my opponent said and some of the questions from the bench regarding the policy issue. First of all, in the complaint, it doesn't say that the school bus driver had a duty to comply with the policy. I submit that that's immaterial. I mean, the bottom line is, in all these cases, the cases from around the nation and the cases from our state, the fact of the matter is what is being accused is a violation of some sort of policy, procedure, or duty. I mean, the cases wouldn't exist but for that allegation. So the policy really is beside the point. It's not mentioned in any of the cases on point. It's because the operation is required to be related to physical control of the functions of the bus. My opponent mentioned the DeRay case, the United States District Court for the District of Colorado, District Court unpublished case, which he said that Judge Krieger allowed a case to proceed. Again, another prisoner case. The case involved a handcuffed prisoner who was placed not adequately secured in the front seat rather than the back seat. So the analysis is very similar to what this court did in Young. And as I stated before, it's obviously distinguishable. I want to make one last comment about my opponent's expansive definition of the term operation of a motor vehicle, which expands beyond what this court has done in any of its cases. There's, and I think counsel was attempting to use a statement that I believe is in the Harris opinion about items or actions or omissions fairly incidental. Well, if you take a look at that language in the Harris opinion, it says that the actions must be fairly incidental to the defects and movements of the bus. So that fairly incidental language does not get the court to anything incidental to driving a bus or being on a bus. Again, it goes back to movements or movements of the bus, defects of the bus, other functions of the bus. So with that, if there are no more questions, Your Honors, my time is about to expire, and I request that the a court reverse the district court's grant or the district court's finding that the motor vehicle operation waiver of government immunity applies to this case.
Thank you, Mr. Case. Thank you again, Mr. Snyder. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. Mr. Snyder, we appreciate your coming here all the way from Durango to present your argument. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.